Well, as they're heading out, I want to ask you this question. When was the first time that you remember seriously asking the question, why did God let this happen? Just like all of you, I've asked that many, many times in my life. Years ago, my wife and I moved down to West Virginia, where I served at a church, Gateway Christian Church, down there. And the first couple that Sarah and I met was a guy named Kelly and his wife, Lori. It was our first Sunday there. It was actually their second Sunday there. So we were all new to that church. And within weeks, we were put into a small group with them. And I was sort of at a weird stage in my life at this point. I was in my mid-20s. I'd only been in ministry for about 4.5 years. And to be honest, I didn't really have any close friends. In college, I got some really bad advice from one of my professors who basically told the ministry students to not develop close friendships with people in your congregation. This professor had seen ministers open up to people in their congregation, and then what they opened up to them about got used against them and got them fired. And so he told us not to make close friendships with people in the church. And again, that was really bad advice, by the way. So in my early years in ministry, I was really guarded. Like now people are like, Steve, you share too much. Like it's TMI, you know, we don't need to hear all the time about how hot your wife is or how gassy you are or whatever. But anyway, I didn't have many close friends at this point in my life. So when we got to Gateway, again, we met with Kelly and Lori, and Kelly was just different. And he and I immediately hit it off. He was just one of those guys that was just magnetic. People were just drawn to him. And he was so caring and he was concerned about me that I ended up just dropping my guard and opening up to him. And I hadn't done that for a long time. And he wouldn't have it any other way. It's like he insisted. And it didn't take long before Kelly was one of my closest friends. He was just one of those guys that was always serving, always making people laugh, always made people feel at ease. He just loved Jesus. And so a couple years after we met Kelly and Lori, Lori was a teacher and she had a student in one of her classes that had a really rough home life. He was in a foster home and he was going to be moved to another foster home, and this had happened several times. And so Kelly and Lori began to pray about what they should do, and they decided that they would foster this child with the intent of adopting him. But the catch was that this child had siblings, and they were all split up into different homes. And so they made the decision that though they didn't have any children of their own, they would pursue fostering to adopt all four of these children to reunite them. And they began inviting these kids into their home to live with them. Well, while they were in this process, Kelly got sick. And doctors thought that he had mono, but it got worse and worse. And finally, he ended up going to the hospital, and I went to visit him in the hospital. And he told me that the doctors were throwing out some possible diagnoses, but one of the thoughts was that they mentioned leukemia. And I don't really think I took that idea seriously because, I mean, Kelly was young, he was a healthy guy, and you never think that someone close to you would have something serious like leukemia. But that being said, I thought, well, you know, even if it's leukemia, we serve a great big God. I'm sure he'll be all right. And sure enough, Kelly was diagnosed with leukemia. And then all of a sudden, their plans for their life, including adoption, had to be put on hold. And eventually, they weren't able to adopt those kids because of his failing health. And those kids went back into the foster system. Kelly was undergoing treatments, but nothing seemed to be working. He was losing weight, and he looked so frail. And finally, as a last resort, they sent him to MD Anderson in Houston, Texas, for some experimental treatments. 10 months after Kelly's initial diagnosis, I flew out to Houston to visit with him and Lori. And you would think that they'd just be worn down and beat up by all the poking and prodding and experimental drugs that they were putting into him. And certainly it had taken a toll on him. But they just laughed. And they just had such incredible faith. They shined. They were so full of joy. I remember laughing because Kelly would just tease with the nurses. And again, he was so sick. And these nurses could tell he was just so different because of his joy. And he just had an incredible attitude, even though outwardly he was wasting away. By this point, Kelly weighed 110 pounds, down from 165. A month later, Kelly was sent back to West Virginia to a hospice house where he would spend his last days. And on March 8th, 2007, 11 months after he was diagnosed with leukemia, and one day before his birthday, Kelly passed away, weighing about 90 pounds. He's such an incredible young man of God, had one of the biggest hearts, and all the while, people, including myself, were asking God, like, why would you allow this to happen? Why would you take Kelly when he was doing so much for other people? Why would you take Kelly, and now you have these four kids who are orphaned again and heading back to the foster system? And why would you take Kelly when he leaves this beautiful young wife to be a widow? Why would you take Kelly when so many friends would miss him so badly? And it just didn't make sense. And to this day, it's been almost 15 years. To this day, though I see some good that came out of his battle, and I know there were many lives that were touched because of his struggle and even in his death, that question is still unanswerable to me. If you have never had your faith shaken by unexplainable suffering, you are rare. Be thankful. But it's coming, I guarantee it. You will someday. I think even the most dedicated believers wonder at times why God permits so much hurt in this world. You know, growing up in church, we learn about how God loves you and how much God cares for you and how God is always at work. But then this thing called life hits you and you start to wonder, God, are you really working? God, are you really listening? God, do you even care? Are you just on some long vacation? Author Brian Jones, in his book, Second Guessing God, talks about how most of us are in this pursuit of our own happiness. And when we don't get that, when we don't achieve that happiness, then we begin to wonder what God is up to. But Jones suggests that God maybe has a different agenda for our lives, that maybe he isn't so interested in our happiness. Instead, that God is interested in transformation. God is interested in deep, lasting, and profound change in our lives. And this kind of change rarely comes from pursuing our happiness, from spending our lives chasing happiness. In fact, transformation most often comes through trial. And not just one trial, but as James says in the Bible, through trials of many kinds. But when these trials of many kinds come, we're compelled to ask, where is God? You ever ask that before? Maybe you've been asking that recently. For the past couple of years, maybe you've asked that as this entire world has been dealing with a global pandemic, as division seems to be widening in our country, as we see spikes in depression and suicide around us, as we watch news stories of oppression, slavery, poverty, and starvation in other parts of the world. It's common to look at the condition of this world and even the condition of our own lives and go, where are you, God? Well, the Bible tells us that for over 400 years, God's people, the Israelites, were slaves in Egypt. They had to have been asking, where are you, God? But finally, God raised up a deliverer in Moses to free the Israelites from their slavery in Egypt. And then he leads them on this journey to the promised land. And it was a journey that should have taken only about 1 month, but instead the people wandered in the wilderness on their journey to the promised land for 40 years. Well, after 40 years, those who were children when they escaped Egypt stood with their children, and they finally viewed the promised land with their own eyes. They could hardly contain their excitement. And so Joshua 3 picks up this story. If you have your Bibles or a Bible app, you can open up to Joshua chapter 3. And as we read this, I want you to picture this massive gathering of people, probably over 1 million people. And these people had waited their entire adult lives for this moment where they would enter into the promised land. And all that stood between them and their future homeland was the Jordan River. Imagine their excitement as Joshua gave the people God's instructions about when and where they were to cross the Jordan and to make their way into the promised land. In Joshua 3:3, the people were given these instructions. It said, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the Levitical priests carrying it, you are to move out from your positions and follow it." And so the priests led the way. They led the way to the edge of the Jordan River, and Joshua gave them instructions from the Lord. Verse 8, "Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." And all this sounds well and good, right? The people follow the priests, they come to the Jordan, they cross the Jordan, and they're basically in their new homeland. All those years of wandering behind them. But the Israelites soon discovered an obstacle. At any other time of the year, God's people could have crossed over. They could have waded across the calm and shallow waters of the Jordan River, but not during harvest. Down in verse 15, we read, "Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest." And guess what time of year it was? You got it. Harvest season. Again, at any other time of the year, this would have been a relatively simple trek. But during harvest season, this normally calm and shallow river turned into raging torrents. Now, why didn't God have them cross earlier in the year? Or why didn't he have them wait just a little bit longer? I mean, they'd waited 40 years. What's a few more weeks? What's a few more months? And we can only imagine how terrifying it must have been for those mothers who are holding the hands of their children thinking, how are we going to do this? For elderly couples who are holding tight to one another. To those with disabilities, they had to have been discouraged thinking, God has taken them this far and now they're not going to be able to cross. I mean, even the strongest among them had to have been thinking, why would God bring us to this point, all the way here, only to let us die? But Joshua told the people in verse 13, "As soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord, the Lord of all the earth, set foot, as soon as they set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand in a heap." So he's saying, you know, once the priests get in the water, they step foot in the Jordan, the water will stop flowing. You think you want to be the first one to step foot in, right? You drawing straws for that? Like, no, it's you. I wonder if they were thinking, you say that the water will stop flowing once we put our feet in, but God, can't you just stop the flow even before we get in? I mean, that's what you did with the parting of the Red Sea, right? It parted, then we walked. And we learned something. We learn that sometimes trusting God means we take an uncertain first step. What they could see in front of them was scary. It was uncertain. And haven't there been times in our lives where God has called us to take a step of faith and we couldn't see what that next step would look like? It was uncertain. But these priests were obedient. We read in verses 15 and 16, "Yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge," so they went in, "the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam." Did you catch that? God instructed the priests to take that first uncertain step into the water. And as soon as the priests' feet touched the water, God stopped the water from flowing. In fact, we read in verse 17 that the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stopped in the middle of the Jordan and stood on dry ground while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. And so the people were able to cross on dry ground. Amazing miracle. End of story, right? Not quite. Because I want you to notice something about this miracle. God stopped the flow of water. He performed this miracle, stopping the flow of the water of Jordan. But did you catch where God stopped the flow of water? Did it stop right there in front of the people where they were standing? Did the Israelites actually see God work with their own eyes right in front of them? No. Again, verse 16 tells us that the water piled up in a heap a great distance away. At a town called Adam, or maybe it was called Adam, because it, you know, stopped the water, right? Scholars estimate that this town of Adam was roughly 19 miles upstream from where the Israelites stood. 19 miles is far beyond their line of sight. 19 miles is far beyond what they could see. And so God performed this amazing miracle, one very reminiscent of a miracle years earlier when he parted the Red Sea. But this miracle was a bit different. It was a miracle that the people didn't actually witness with their own eyes. They saw the impact of this miracle, but God performed the miracle upstream out of their sight. And here's the powerful truth that the children of Israel learned that day, and I think one that still applies to us today, is that God is always at work upstream in our lives. Where is God when we face problems in our lives? Sickness, job loss, depression, tragedy, discouragement. God is at work upstream in those situations, beyond our line of sight. The only thing that the Israelites could see was the problem right in front of them. And they could have concluded that since that raging river was there, that God wasn't actively involved in their situation. But they would have been wrong. He was there. They just couldn't see him at work. When we adopted our youngest daughter, Avery, we adopted her from Florida. And sometime I'd love to share the full story with you. But we got to meet Avery for the first time when she was about 1 week old. She was living at that time with her biological aunt. Now, most people in our situation would have gotten a call from the adoption agency that the baby was going to be born. We would head down to the hospital, sign some papers, and we would leave the hospital with our baby. But because of a situation that happened before we ever gotten involved, we had to wait to appear before a judge before we were granted guardianship. So we flew down from West Virginia down to Florida, and every day while we were down there, we would call to see if we were scheduled for a hearing to go before the judge. And every day we would have no answer as to when we would get a hearing. So we would then have scheduled visits to see Avery while she stayed at her aunt's house, and we would get to see her then. But it was so frustrating. And I remember after over a week of this, waiting and still not having answers, I went out and I took a run. And as I was running, I just kind of had it out with God. I complained to God. I argued with him. I vented my frustration. I'm sure people seeing me thought I was a little bit crazy because I'm running angry, right? But I would just be like, God, we feel like you led us to adopt. And all these things keep lining up for us to move forward. We've sought you. We've sought your will in this whole time. And now here we are. We're in the final stages. And you stop working? You stop moving? And after 2.5 weeks of being down in Florida with only scheduled visits to see Avery and no hearing scheduled, we flew back home to West Virginia without our child. I was angry. I was frustrated. I was even a little bit embarrassed. I mean, we had so many people praying for us, and it felt like we were coming home because God didn't answer those prayers. After returning home, we found out that we finally got a hearing. And so a little over a week after being home, Sarah and I flew back down to Florida to have our hearing. We were given legal guardianship of Avery. We signed all the papers. And when Avery was 1 month old, we were able to bring her home to her forever family. Since then, I've been able to have a little bit of perspective on that situation. And we've seen that in that period of waiting, which let's face it, it wasn't even that long. I guess I'm a little bit impatient. That period of waiting, that period of feeling like God wasn't working, we were able to see that God was up to something. He was working that whole time. It's just that he was working out of our line of sight. He was working upstream where we couldn't see. You see, if we had not had that period of waiting, we wouldn't have had those scheduled visits to visit Avery, and we wouldn't have gotten to know her family, her biological family. We wouldn't know her half-siblings. We wouldn't know her aunt and uncle, her cousins, her grandparents. We wouldn't have known her biological mom. And now we take a trip almost once a year down to Florida, and while we're down there, we visit with the family. We call them our Florida family. And it's been so good for us to know some of Avery's history. We even contacted them like soon after we brought Avery home because there was a medical issue, and we were able to ask some questions about the mom's medical history, and we wouldn't have had that relationship. That wouldn't have formed if things had gone according to my plan, if they had gone according to my timing. But God was working. Even when I couldn't see it, God was at work upstream. And so what do we do then in these moments of time where it seems like we can't see what God is up to? What do we do when it feels like God isn't moving, like God isn't working? Well, what was it that the Israelites did that demonstrated their faith in God? They trusted what they could not see, and they let go of what they couldn't control. And I think that's a valuable truth for us too, that we need to trust what you cannot see and let go of what you cannot control. Oftentimes, God won't work in a situation until we finally get out of the way. And as long as we continue to try and meddle with our problem or try and fix it ourselves or try and take control, then we haven't turned it completely over to God, so he can't or won't work on it. Now, I'm usually not the greatest example of relinquishing control to God. I have some issues with that. But after my freshman year of college, I started feeling a call to go into ministry, but I was fighting it. Like, I wanted to make money, and I don't know if you've read Forbes lately, but pastors don't usually land on that list of top-paying jobs. And so I was fighting this, and again, sometime I'd love to share the whole story with you, but after contemplating this decision for my future, it really came down to the night before I was supposed to go back to college for my sophomore year, I was trying to decide if I should actually be going back or if I should be transferring the next day and go somewhere else to go into ministry. And that night, I finally, I'd been just so stressed about this decision, I finally laid down and I prayed a very simple prayer. It was a very difficult prayer, but a very simple one. I said, God, I don't know what I'm supposed to do tomorrow. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. And I don't want to make that decision. I want you to take control, and I want you to make this decision for me. And I'll do whatever you want me to do. I don't think I'd ever prayed a prayer like that before that point in my life where I just completely relinquished it over to God. You know, you ever pray prayers where you put conditions on things or pray prayers where you act like you're letting go, but you're really still holding on to control, or you pray prayers where you're the one who's going to get the final word in the matter. I've done that lots of times. I still probably do that every once in a while, but not this time. I completely let go of control, and that is something that is totally against my nature. But after I prayed that prayer, though I had no idea what direction God would lead me, where I would head, I slept peacefully knowing it's in God's hands. He's in control. And the next morning I woke up and my mom said, so where are we going today? Are we going west, which meant I would go back to the school I had gone to my freshman year, or are we going south, which meant I would transfer to Kentucky Christian University and go into ministry? And I took a deep breath and I said, I think we're going south. And I had a peace about the decision because I had put it in God's hands to control. Again, this was rare for me to give up control, but looking back on that moment, there were so many ways in which God had been moving and working in my life up to that point to get me to the place that he wanted me to be, even though I didn't notice it, even though I didn't quite see how he's working in the moment. And that journey has not always been easy. Ministry isn't always easy. I can see, though, that God was working upstream in my life. But some people, they can't see God at work upstream in their lives, not because they lack faith, but because they insist on having too much control. You know, this idea of God working upstream, working in ways that we cannot see, it's actually echoed in the New Testament. One of my favorite passages is from Romans 8:28. The Apostle Paul would say this. He would say, "And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." Now, notice in this passage, it doesn't say that all things are good. No. And it doesn't say all things work out the way I want them to. And it doesn't say, well, we hope that God can work something good out of this situation. No, it says, we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. And so I just kind of want to wrap up this morning with two brief applications to this verse. And the first is this: there's a difference between reason and purpose. There's a difference between reason and purpose. Does that make sense? Like when someone goes through something difficult in life, many of us want to say, well, there's always a reason for it. You'll hear this oftentimes. Well-meaning people will try to comfort someone who's struggling, and they'll say things like, well, God has his reasons. Or they'll say something like, well, there's a reason for everything, and I've probably said that in my life before. We want to believe that there's a reason for everything, but in fact, God doesn't have a reason for everything. Like God didn't have a reason for that school shooting or that car bombing, and maybe he didn't have a reason behind that person hurting you the way that they did. And if there really is a reason for everything, more often than not, the pain that we experience, they're not God's reasons. It's sin. That's the reason. It's that we live in a fallen world. That's the reason. The reason is that we have an enemy who comes to kill and steal and destroy. That's the reason. And so God may not have a reason, but he always has a purpose. And these are two different things. See, reason looks for a because. Like it wants to answer the question why. This happened because of this. But purpose looks for a for. A reason wants a logical explanation to make sense out of something that specific that's happened. But purpose offers us hope that whatever happened, good or bad, God can still work for the good. The Israelites got to witness God was working for their good soon after their struggle, right? They got to see it very soon after. But there were many times that they didn't get to see it right away. And there will be many times we may not be able to see it right away. And definitely, we may not be able to see it fully. I still look back on things in my life and still wonder, okay, God, how are you going to work this for good? But we can trust, we can know that God can and will work even the most disappointing things of life for good. Second thing you need to understand is this, that God does not cause everything, but God does cause everything to work together for the good of those who love him. So Christians believe that God is sovereign. That means that God rules and reigns over everything, that he's in control, right? But there's some dispute as to how God expresses his sovereignty. Like some take the position that God is sovereign in that he's like a puppet master controlling every situation, that he predetermines everything that we do. But I see a difference between predeterminism and foreknowledge, meaning that God may know what is going to happen, but he doesn't necessarily determine what will happen beforehand. And in my mind, that's an even higher view of God's sovereignty. It's not that God causes everything. It's that he causes everything to work together for the good of those who love him. And that's a whole other level of sovereignty and power, isn't it? That he can take whatever has happened. He can take the choices that we make in our free will, the choices that others make in their free will, even choices to hurt us. And he, in his sovereignty, can use it, even the bad things, to accomplish his work and his purpose. To me, this demonstrates a God who is actively involved in the lives of his free-thinking, free-acting creation. And what this means for us that love God is that he can take the bad. He can take the hurt. He can take the disappointment and the pain and the raging rivers of life and the stuff that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy and even the sin. And he can use it. He can use it to accomplish good and accomplish his purposes. And this is no more evident in the cross of Jesus Christ, right? What looked like, from an outsider standpoint, the worst thing ever, he turned and used for the good, the rescuing us from the slavery of our sins. And so this should give us great perspective on our pain and suffering and our times of waiting, because we know that in all things, even in the chaos of life, even in the raging rivers of life, God works for those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. So may we trust that God is at work, even when we can't see him. Even when we can't understand it, may we trust that God is at work upstream in our lives. Let's pray.